to this mini masterclass on how to stop screens from sabotaging sleep. My name is Dr. Christy Goodwin, and I'm a digital wellbeing and performance researcher, speaker, and author, and also a mum to her own children. And we are really worried about the current, what I call, sleep epidemic that we are facing here, both in Australia and internationally. And this is an issue that is relevant to both students in primary school, secondary school, and also pertinent to adults who are tethered to technology, leading increasingly busy lives, and who wear sleep deprivation almost like a badge of honour. In this masterclass, I'm going to explain focusing specifically on young children and adolescents in terms of why sleep is critical, how much they need, the ways in which screens and technology are contributing to this sleep epidemic, and also about practical, realistic strategies to ensure that children and adolescents develop healthy sleep habits. So let's dive in. We know that studies are telling us, and anecdotally I'm hearing from teachers, from health professionals, that we are seeing a huge decline in both the quality and quantity of sleep that children are getting. I hear numerous teachers tell me that children are falling asleep in their classes, and not because their instruction is boring, but because they are chronically sleep deprived. Now, as I'll explain in this masterclass, technology is definitely a contributing factor, but it is not the only causal factor. So we know, for example, that 25% of teenagers are reporting not getting a sufficient amount of sleep on school nights. Now, I don't know if you can remember back to the early days, I'm in the middle of it at the moment as I record this with a newborn baby, but how difficult it was to function, let alone to learn, when you are not getting good enough sleep, both in terms of quality and quantity as well. Studies have told us that 20% of teenagers are falling asleep in class, and 18% are telling us they're falling asleep whilst they're studying. The Australian Health Poll in 2017 revealed that almost half, in fact 43% of children are using digital devices before they go to bed, and one in four of these children, in fact about 26%, are reporting having sleep problems. And we know that sleep is critical, as I'll show in this masterclass, for a range of well-being and learning indicators. For example, we know that children who don't get adequate amounts of sleep, that their IQ can, you know, a 30-minute drop in sleep can result in their IQ diminishing by up to 10 points. We know that insufficient sleep is highly correlated with other poor mental health outcomes. So sleep is really vital, but so many of us, both children, adolescents, and adults, aren't getting a sufficient amount. Now, if you haven't already done so, please make sure you've downloaded the PDF summary sheet that is underneath this video. It contains all the pertinent information from this masterclass in a printed sheet that you can access. So when you see images like this, and these are gathered throughout the world, not just, you know, specific to Asian countries, but we know we have a really serious health epidemic when we have got people making accommodations to trains and public transport to try and catch up on some shut-eye. We know many adults and parents are actually really poor role models. If we assessed how adults are using their digital devices, particularly around bedtime, we would know that we're not demonstrating good sleep hygiene. You know, for example, even on silent, having your phone adjacent to your bed can still be a mental trigger if you see it in your room. I often say to adults, and I don't say this to teenagers, and I certainly don't say this to young children, but we need to form good sleep associations. And that means that we need to associate our bedroom for the two S's, sleep and sex. It's certainly not sleep, sex, and screens, as many of us are doing. So we're not good role models, and some data in 2019 has come out that tells us that many adults, in fact, a significant proportion of adults, are reporting sleeping with their digital appendage. We know, for example, that teenagers are particularly vulnerable to the effects of screens, as I'll explain in this masterclass. In fact, 70% of 14-year-old girls are telling us they're not getting sufficient sleep. Most of them are recording less than 8 hours each night, when 8 to 10 hours is the minimum required. But as I've alluded to already, technology isn't the only culprit. Now, I'm going to tell you a story about a girl called Rebecca. She's very emblematic of teenage girls. Rebecca's in year 10, and she goes to bed somewhere between 10:30 and 11:30 p.m. at night. She admits that she's using Snapchat, she's checking out Instagram, she's on WhatsApp with her friends, And she owns up to the fact that she's only allowed on social media between 4 and 10pm each night. However, she often doesn't begin her homework until somewhere around 9:30pm. This means that despite her curfew and her digital curfew, often she's still up late at night doing online work, while her parents, themselves tired, have nodded off to sleep down the corridor and are often completely oblivious to the fact that she is staying up much, much later than what they thought she was, and often tethered to her device just before bed. So, in this masterclass, I'm going to cover these four areas. I'm going to explain what goes on in the brain and why it's so critical for our young people, how much sleep kids and teenagers need at different chronological ages, how screens might be contributing to this sleep problem, and what we can do. What are some healthy sleep habits, both in terms of using technology, but some more general research-based, neuroscientifically validated strategies that will help to promote sleep. Sleep is critical, and from experience, I have found working with thousands of young people that we get the best buy-in when it comes to sleep. And I'll be honest, sleep isn't a particularly exciting topic to sell to young people, but I've found we get the best buy-in when we focus in on the positive benefits that sleep offers our young people, as opposed to really just focusing in on what happens when they don't get enough sleep. I think we get a greater uptake and a greater appreciation of sleep when young people get to see just how pivotal it is for their overall health and well-being and their performance as well. So we know and we need to communicate to our young people that sleep supports their brain and their body. It helps with their mood and their overall physical and mental health and well-being. You see, sleep makes kids smart, happy and healthy, and we need to be focusing in on this and this messaging to our young people. However, as adults, we also need to know that for our young people, insufficient sleep and or poor quality sleep is negatively associated with their alertness, their capacity to learn, memory formation, emotional health and well-being, capacity to pay attention and to concentrate, impaired immunity, poorer reaction times, increased obesity rates, and poorer impulse control. We know that if young people are awake for 17 hours, or for any of us adults as well, for 17 hours in a 24-hour period, it's the equivalent to an adult driving under the influence. If you've got young boys, particularly adolescent boys, giving them some confronting statistics can get them to actually buy in. We don't want to overwhelm them, as I said, with the negative associations with poor sleep. But if we can hit them where it hurts, pardon the pun, telling them that there are studies that have been shown that insufficient sleep impacts the reproductive system. We know, for example, men who sleep 5 to 6 hours per night have testosterone levels that are equivalent to somebody who is 10 years older. So if they want to bolster their testosterone, they need to sleep. And we also know from emerging research that poor sleep or a lack of sleep is associated with Alzheimer's disease. And neuroscientist Matthew Walker, who is a sleep expert and someone who I've recommended in the resource section of this masterclass, has conducted some research that tells us that a toxic protein in the brain that's called beta amyloid, which is associated with Alzheimer's disease, what happens is when we sleep, our brain starts to activate a sewage system. It kicks in when we sleep, kicks into high gear, in fact, and it starts to wash away this toxic protein. But if we're not getting enough sleep, we think this may be one of the reasons that can contribute to Alzheimer's disease. So again, probably not on the radar of our young people, but we really need to start to communicate to them that sleep is really, really critical for their overall health and well-being. We've got some other studies, a study published in the Journal of Neuroscience, and this was a study done with mice because it's obviously difficult to get ethics approval where we have human participants. But this study where mice were deprived of sleep, the researchers discovered that part of their brain, something called their locus cerebellus neurons, their LCNs in the mice brains, which are essential for being alert. This is basically the LCNs help keep us alert. This part of the brain actually began to die off. These neurons are continuously firing without enough rest, and basically they become worn out, they become damaged and eventually destroyed. And what was really scary in this study was that the mice lost a whopping 25% of their LCNs after just 3 days of 4 to 5 hours worth of sleep. So the researchers suggest, and I guess they're hypothesizing, that the same thing could happen in human brains. So basically, inadequate sleep could quite literally kill your brain cells. So no wonder, and again, more evidence why it's so hard for us to concentrate and to focus when we are tired. So again, I have found working with young people that communicating what goes on, particularly boys and adolescent boys and girls, really like to know the science and the reasoning behind why you're really passionate about a topic. And what I found is that young people actually appreciate knowing what's going on in their brain. Many of us are under the impression that our brain goes to sleep while we sleep at night. But the reality is this is very far from the truth. Our brain is very active while we sleep. And I explain to kids when I work with them and teenagers that our brain basically performs two things. It ironically behaves a little bit like a computer when we sleep. And the first thing the brain does while we sleep is it does a backup. Like our hard drive gets backed up, the neural pathways, the connection and the information that we need to shift from our short-term memory to our long-term memory happens whilst we sleep. This is a really critical part of our sleep. It is basically, sleep acts like the save button. It helps to back up the really important information. It transitions things from our short-term to long-term information. We also know that sleep is really critical for another process, and that is neural pruning. While we sleep, the brain gets rid of any neural pathways or connections that are redundant. Information, facts, and skills that are superfluous, extraneous, no longer required, redundant, get pruned away. And again, this can only occur while we are asleep. So this lymphatic system, which is the brain's waste removal, also carries out toxins when we sleep. So the brain is performing a whole lot of really critical functions, and these can only occur whilst we are sleeping. We are not like dolphins that can switch off our brain and have half on and half off and do this whilst we're awake. All of this must occur whilst we are asleep. So we need to be communicating to our young people that this is really critical. So, what are the costs? What are the costs of not getting enough sleep? We need to really focus in. One of the huge crises we are facing with adolescents in particular at the moment is the mental health crisis. We are seeing huge increases in mental health disorders such as anxiety and depression, and there is some emerging research that is suggesting that perhaps sleep is a contributing factor. We don't yet have conclusive evidence, and we're not quite sure which way the causational arrow points yet. Is it inadequate sleep that is contributing to poorer mental health outcomes, or is it the other way around, where poorer mental health outcomes are contributing to poorer sleep quality? But what we know is that several studies have proven that young people are much more likely to suffer from depression, anxiety if they're not getting enough sleep. In fact, a 2010 study found that teenagers who went to bed after midnight were diagnosed as suffering from more negative mood swings. They were 24% more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety, and they were 20% more likely to consider harming themselves. We've got other long-term studies that have demonstrated that poor sleep in adolescents is a very strong predictor of elevated risks for depression, anxiety, and suicide in adulthood. Sleep-deprived teenagers are much more prone to developing a negative body image and have also associations with low self-esteem and a loss in their sense of humor. So sleep is really critical for bolstering our young people's emotions, their mood, their stress, and their rates of anxiety and depression. A rather large-scale study involving 11 to 17-year-olds over a 12-month period asked them a diverse range of indicators and questions about their psychological, interpersonal, and body functioning. And they found that 46% of teenagers had reported negative symptoms, so had poorer psychological, interpersonal, and body functioning outcomes, and if they were getting insufficient amounts of sleep. So we have a very strong reciprocal relationship between insomnia, so poor quality or quantity of sleep, and psychosocial effects, depression, anxiety, irritability, anger, etc. Sleep really is critical for our young people's mental health. We know from our experience as adults, when we're tired, we tend to be a lot more grumpy. And this is exacerbated in our young people when we think of the hormonal changes that are also occurring in the prepubescent and pubescent years as well. We also know there are psychosocial costs associated with inadequate amounts of sleep. A 2010 study with over 8,000 teenagers that was conducted over an 8-year period found that sleep-deprived teenagers were more likely to use drugs, tobacco, and alcohol, and this also increased their vulnerability to long-term dependence. Why is this the case? We know that the prefrontal cortex of the brain basically switches off when we are tired. The brain goes into safety mode, it goes into basic functioning, and that part of the brain, that frontal lobe, is associated with impulse control. This is why, as adults, speaking from experience here, we make poorer food choices, or we binge watch more television, or we use more social media when we are tired. The impulse control center of the brain, that frontal lobe, is impaired when we're not getting enough sleep. I've also found, again, as I mentioned, talking about the positive aspects or trying to find data that gets our kids and teens' pain point. So talking to them about Alzheimer's probably isn't on their radar when they are young people, but talking to them about how poor sleep can affect their sporting ability may in fact entice them to get more sleep. A study with NBA basketballers, for example, showed that there were significant improvements when the players optimized their sleep. This study found that their reaction times were quicker, they had much greater shooting accuracy, they were able to sprint faster, and they were able to remember some of the plays that they needed to commit to memory. We've had other studies that are telling us that sleep deprivation in teens is often associated with having a much more difficult relationship with their parents, much more higher incidence of being late for school and increased rates of absenteeism and detention. We also know that it's having a really big impact on their physical health and well-being. We know, for example, that when our young people sleep, in fact, all of us sleep, something called the human growth hormone is released. And this is integral to a teenager's physical well-being and their growth. It helps to repair or restore damaged skin, muscle, and bone cells, and promotes the growth of new cells. So again, appealing to our young people's desire to look and feel good, reminding them that sleep will actually help with their physical appearance is a good way to tap into that desirability. We also know that sleep boosts immunity. Many of us know we get really, when we're tired, we tend to pick up more colds. Basically, when we're not getting enough sleep, it causes the number of T cells in a young person's body to fall by between 30 and 40%. So it basically reduces their ability of their immune system to fight off everyday infections. So sleep literally helps young people fight off infections and colds. So we also know, and this is why, our body tends to crave more sleep when we are sick. We know that in our body has a chemical called cytokines, and these are released in the immune system and they help to promote sleepiness. We think these hormones have evolved because we know that sleep helps to conserve energy, which is needed by the immune system to stop us from being sick. We've got other studies that tell us that sleep-deprived teens get many more headaches than those teens that are having sufficient amount of sleep. We also know that sleep can help with healthy weight and also can prevent the onset of obesity. Appetite control hormones are released when we sleep. For example, leptin, which is a hormone that tells our brain that we are full, and ghrelin, another hormone that helps with our healthy weight, are released whilst we sleep. We've got studies, a study in the International Journal of Obesity, published in 2011, found that teenagers who slept for less than 8 hours per night had higher values of body mass index, body fat, higher waist and hip circumferences, and higher fat indexes. We again know insulin, which is another hormone that controls the body's use of energy, it literally can be affected by sleep. We also, again, know that sleep can raise our sensation of hunger by 25%. This is, again, a factor of the hormones, those hormones that aren't released while we're sleeping, the hormones that are not released when we're not getting a sufficient amount of sleep. They help regulate hunger. But again, the impaired frontal lobe, that impulse control center of the brain, is affected when we are tired. And the final way that inadequate sleep is impacting our young people is that it impairs their capacity to learn. I don't know about you, if you can remember back to having a newborn baby, or perhaps you came back from a long-haul international flight and you were chronically sleep-deprived, you couldn't imagine trying to learn. And this is the reality that many of our young people find themselves in every single day in the classroom, chronically sleep-deprived, and it's having a really negative impact on their learning. It literally sabotages your focus. Now, for a long time, the research has told us that sleep is really vital after we've learned something. A good night's sleep after you've learned some new information basically hits the save button in your brain. As I mentioned before, it's the brain consolidating information and moving information from your short-term to your long-term brain. However, new research is telling us that sleep is also vital before our kids learn. Memory circuits basically become waterlogged if they're not getting enough sleep. So it makes the brain incapable of absorbing new information. As I said at the beginning of this, and as in your handouts, we know that studies have also shown that 30 minutes of missed sleep can result in an IQ difference of 10 points. We know that inadequate amount of sleep impairs learning and memory. US studies have shown that students, particularly teenagers who score low academic results, so C, Ds and Es in school tests, tend to have an average of 30 minutes less sleep per night than teens who regularly get A's and B's. A Tel Aviv study was conducted a couple of years ago, and they found that children in grade 6 who were deprived of just 1 hour sleep each night performed at an academic level equivalent to fourth graders. Basically, when our young people, our children and our teens are sleep deprived, their body is on panic mode. Their body is only able to focus on being tired, resulting in this willingness and a motivation to learn. So, sleep is really critical for a whole range of reasons, not just for academic, but also for their mental well-being and their physical and emotional well-being as well. So this leads into, how much sleep do our kids and teens need? Now, this often comes as a shock when I work with students and I ask them to quantify how much sleep they acquired the previous night. Many of them put up one hand, so they're getting sometimes 5 or less hours of sleep. Now, we've got ample evidence, and again, this evidence is backed up by science, and it's fairly consistent, that tells us that children and teens have a really prescriptive amount of sleep that they need. So for preschoolers, they need 10 to 13 hours per night. Primary school kids need somewhere between 9 and 11 hours. Teenagers, despite what they think and they will try and convince you, they need somewhere in the vicinity of 8 to 10 hours. The magic number at the moment is suggesting around 9 hours for teenagers. And for adults, somewhere between 7 to 9 hours per night. Now, for those of us who try and say, look, I can get by, I thrive on only 2 or 3 hours worth of sleep, or I'm a bit like Steve Irwin was and other previous US presidents who have been known to, claim that they lived off very little sleep, the research tells us that there is only a really insignificant proportion of the population who can get less and who can cope with less than the recommended amount of sleep. These people are definitely the exception rather than the rule. These are anomalies. These guidelines are fairly robustly tested, and these are guidelines that children really must and teenagers must meet. Again, these will be in your handout if you want to print them out, tattoo them to your children or to your teenager. But again, reminding them this is validated on research and science. So let's look, and I want to point out here, screens aren't the only reason why we are seeing a decline in sleep. They are definitely a contributing factor. Some other factors that we need to look at, I believe we've got overscheduled, busy, hurried childhoods and adolescents. Many adolescents are telling us they have an inordinate amount of schoolwork, homework and assignments, many of which often have due dates or due times around midnight. And this is one of the strong recommendations I make when I'm working with teachers and schools. A simple accommodation for schools is to bring your homework or assignment deadline forward. Unfortunately, and I know this pains teachers to hear, but if you've got a midnight deadline, I hate to break it to you, but many students are starting work on that project or assignment at 10 p.m. at night. Some other factors that are compromising sleep, extracurricular or co-curricular activities that students are engaged in, the demands of schoolwork, and other competing life forces. Many know that there's often a term we call comorbidity. So this is the presence of multiple symptoms occurring simultaneously. So often poor sleep is associated with poor mental health outcomes, which can be associated again in a reciprocal way. So how do kids sleep and how might screens be impacting? Well, sleep is determined by circadian rhythms and also by sleep pressure, which is another way of saying the sleep drive. Our circadian rhythm acts like an alert signal. At the beginning of the day, it helps to make us feel alert and awake, and it is a reduced signal at night. It helps us to really predict day and night. We also have this, what we call a homeostatic sleep drive, and this is basically the sleep pressure that builds up. It's the amount of accumulated wakefulness, and this is why when we talk about napping, we've got to be particularly careful. Now, we know that circadian rhythms are very susceptible to light. Light is one of the most powerful signals in our environment, and it regulates our brain's internal clock, and it affects our sleep patterns, our health, mood, and a whole lot more. So it's our internal clock, which is also called our circadian rhythm, which uses light to keep our bodies in sync with the day-night patterns of the outside world. However, you can see here just how susceptible young children and adolescents are if their light levels are being affected by tablets and touchscreen devices and laptops and computers, etc. So the brain is really set up to respond to sun and to light, and light that mimics the sun can really affect our sleep and our behavior. And this is particularly the case when light has what we call a high illuminance, and it can really trick the brain into thinking that it needs to be awake when in actual fact it needs to be asleep.
Sometimes wake up because of notifications.
I try not to sleep with my phone like on the pillow next to me.
I use my phone as an alarm.
3 or 4 times a week it will be an inconvenience that I'm woken up and I can't go back to sleep. It happened this morning.
Phone usage and screen time usage is a big problem, and it does cause a lot of fights.
Phone use doesn't really cause arguments.
They're never big arguments.
So, a study was released in 2019 from Common Sense Media called The New Normal. And they found, and I've shared some of the statistics in the handout that accompanies this masterclass, but we know that 70% of children admit to checking their mobile phone, or mobile device, I should say, within 30 minutes of falling asleep. And when we talk about practical strategies to promote healthy sleep, you'll see this is certainly something that can compromise good quality sleep. 54% of teenagers admit to waking up intermittently throughout the night because of alerts and notifications, or intentionally waking up to check social media. Many children admit to having their device, a digital device, within reach of their bed. In fact, 39% of respondents from this Common Sense Media study said that they do. And it won't surprise you, girls tend to sleep with their mobile devices more than boys. 33% of girls compared to 26% of boys are sleeping with their digital appendage. Now, this study really provides concrete evidence that we have become tethered to technology and in really significant ways that is compromising our sleep. So I mentioned before, the blue light effect is one of the most significant ways that technology is affecting our circadian rhythms. At night, our brain and our children's brains, the pineal gland in the brain, needs to release melatonin. Melatonin is a sleep hormone. However, if we are using digital devices, particularly handheld devices that are backlit with a blue light, so smartphones and tablets, sometimes small handheld gaming consoles, this blue light can prevent the pineal gland from making a sufficient amount of melatonin. So basically, it can delay the onset of sleep because the body isn't making the melatonin, the sleep hormone that it needs to fall asleep quickly and easily. Now, these sleep delays might only be 10 minutes, 20 minutes, but over a period of time, these sleep delays can accumulate into a really significant sleep deficit. And again, we've got ample evidence if we're not getting a sufficient amount of sleep, it can really compromise, as I've suggested, our learning, our well-being, and our mood. Another reason why screens are compromising sleep is because we know, and this is a sort of a side tact here, that screen use should be minimized at night, not only because it's impacting sleep, but it's a significant risk factor for cyberbullying or for online predators approaching children. At night, the frontal lobe of the brain, so the part of the brain that manages our impulses, and it's the logical, smart part of the brain, it turns off, and a part of the brain instead called the amygdala, the emotional center, fires up. So this means our children are particularly illogical and highly emotional at night, meaning they're very susceptible to the negative effects. So this can obviously have an impact on their sleep, but also on their general well-being. Another way that technology is impacting our kids and teens' sleep is if they're using a device before they go to bed, and if they view scary or upsetting or distressing content, it can psychologically distress kids. We know, for example, that children under 10 years of age are susceptible to experiencing intense fear if they've viewed a disturbing set of footage or images, because they cannot distinguish fiction from reality until they're somewhere between 8 to 10 years. Now, many parents will restrict, and wisely so, restrict their kids' access to violent movies or video games, but sometimes we forget that the television news program or social media can contain scary or upsetting content. We also know movie trailers and promotions are another source of content that we need to avoid. In recent times, the Momo Challenge, I know, has provided many parents and kids with cause for concern because they have been exposed to scary content often at night before they go to sleep. We know that if kids and teens are using interactive devices, so they're using smartphones or gaming consoles where they are engaging and interacting with the device, it can have a hyperarousal effect. So basically, it can hyperarouse, overstimulate the brain, meaning that it's much more difficult to wind down and go to sleep. So this will be one of the strategies we talk about later in terms of doing a screen swap. If your children or teens are going to use a device before bed, some screens are better than others. We also know that children and adolescents are not getting a sufficient number of sleep cycles each night. So each night when we go to sleep, as you can see on the screen here, we move through 5 stages of sleep. And this cycle should be repeated 4 to 6 times each night for optimal health and well-being. However, if our children and adolescents have digital devices in their bedroom, they get an alert or a notification in between their stages of sleep. Once they reach for their phone or reach for their tablet and check what the notification or alert was, once they go back to sleep, they start right back at stage 1. So they're not getting into stages 4 and 5, and this is where we know memory consolidation occurs. These deep stages of sleep can be really critical for the brain to engage in that computer backup that I talked about before. This is where information shifts from the short term to the long term memory. And so this is why often learning is being compromised in classrooms. This is why employee well-being in the workplace is being compromised, because many of us just aren't getting a sufficient number of completed sleep cycles. I don't know if you can remember back to the newborn baby days. As I said, I'm in the throes of it at the moment, so I'm speaking from first-hand experience here. You may have hit the jackpot and got the magical sort of 8 or 9 hours worth of sleep, but perhaps you got up 6 times in the night to pat a baby or to pick them up or to settle a baby. So you may not have got a completed number of sleep cycles. The final way that we know that comes as quite as a shock to parents, particularly of young parents, is what we call premature waking. Many parents are anecdotally telling me that their children, and not so much adolescents, because we know it's really hard to get adolescents to wake up because they're often tethered to their technology before they go to bed really late, But we know that many parents are telling us that their children are waking up at earlier and earlier ages, at earlier and earlier times, I should say, to get their dose of digital before their parents wake up. In my parents' seminars, I share a story of a three-year-old girl who was waking up every day before her parents and using the iPad downstairs. Now, if I'm really honest, her parents were grateful for the extra 20 minutes sleeping that afforded them, but they were somewhat concerned by what she may have been accessing unsupervised. So they decided to change the 6-digit passcode on the iPad, hoping that that would alleviate the situation. However, it didn't, and the situation continued. So on about the third day, Mum was sleeping and heard the pitter-patter of little footsteps coming in the room, and there was their 3-year-old daughter sneaking in and popping the iPad under her dad's thumbprint, unlocking it, and going downstairs to get her dose of digital. So if you don't want to be in that predicament, I suggest turning off routers, setting up internet filtering tools. The tool, and I'll pop this in the handouts, the tool I personally use and recommend is called the Family Zone. With the Family Zone and with many of these internet filtering tools or parental controls and restrictions, you can in fact set sleep hours. So you can prescribe the times of the day where children cannot get access to the Wi-Fi network or to their mobile phone, etc. So as you can see, screens can definitely contribute to poor sleep habits and hygiene, predominantly through compromising circadian rhythms through the blue light effect. But there are other ways, as we've discussed, such as being exposed to scary or violent content, the hyperarousal effect, and even premature waking, which can also lead to poor sleep habits. So in the final part of this mini masterclass, I'm going to arm you with some healthy sleep habits. Some of these strategies will, of course, encompass how we can tame our technology habits, but I'm also going to suggest some generic research-based strategies that will also promote healthy sleep hygiene with young children. Now, you're not going to need this particular strategy. I had a mum attend one of my seminars and she told me very proudly that she thought she had come up with a genius hack for managing her 10-year-old son's screen use at night. He had downloaded an app that she had strictly told him was prohibited. Not only had he downloaded it, but he'd shown his younger sibling. So a natural consequence and not a punishment, if you've ever heard me speak, I make it very clear that we really need to avoid using screen time as a punishment, but that's a separate topic. But this particular mum followed through on her consequences, and one of the consequences was that if her son downloaded a prohibited app, he would lose access to his device. So she confiscated her 10-year-old son's device and said to him that she was going to sleep with his mobile phone in her bedroom. She was going to charge it up for him so that he could have it the next day at school, but she threatened that she would sleep stark naked and she would sleep on top of the bed covers. Now, she was true to her word and was feeling very proud of herself, thinking there's no way my 10-year-old son's going to walk in and find me in my naked glory, so there's no way he'll sneak in and sneak his phone back out. And that was true, but she made one really careless error, and that was that she forgot to turn her son's phone to airplane mode or to switch it off. Now, he was 10, and his phone did not stop getting alerts and notifications until 11:45 at night, and they started again the next morning at 5:30 in the morning. So many parents I speak to are completely oblivious to their child or their teenager's digital habits and how it might be encroaching on their sleep. And so many students themselves tell me that their parents have absolutely no idea, firstly, what they're doing on their devices at night, and secondly, just how frequently and how late they are using them. So please, let's implement some of these strategies that don't rely on nudity. So the first one I say to when I work with students is to actually work backwards. I suggest students, and I use when I work with students, a clock wheel, and we have a 24-hour clock with the hours from 12 a.m. to 12 p.m. And what I say to students is work out what time you have to wake up. Unfortunately, in most states in Australia, and this is the case in internationally as well, school start times haven't really accommodated our young people's preferred later start time. Most schools still have around an 8:30, 9 a.m. start, if not sometimes earlier. So if that is the case, it means that students need to work backwards and figure out what time they need to be up to be ready in time for that school start time. And so what I suggest students do is calculate the amount of time they need based on this wake-up time. What happens in many instances, we focus predominantly on when kids go to sleep, but with very little consideration to when they actually either naturally wake up due to their circadian rhythms, due to perhaps light factors, or when they have to wake up because of timetables or bus schedules, etc. So really important that we work out when we need to wake up, so that they can not only, and what I get students to do is to not only set their bedtime based on the amount of hours that they need, based on the government recommendations, but to then also set in a digital bedtime as well for their devices. And ideally to counteract that negative impact of the blue light that we talked about in the previous section, we strongly suggest at least 60 minutes, even 90 minutes before a student, a primary or a secondary school student, goes to bed. And if you've still got toddlers and little ones, before they even have a nap, will really make a big difference on the quality and quantity of their sleep. So plan your sleep time. Keep bedrooms as a tech-free zone. Many students say, but I have my device switched on airplane mode, it's on silent. Even the mere presence of your device in your bedroom can be a mental trigger. Students may wake up naturally to go to the bathroom or get a glass of water, and seeing the alarm clock can be a trigger to think about how many likes their Instagram post got, or how many Fortnite battles they've missed out on how many WhatsApp messages they'll need to respond to in the morning. And the same thing is true for us as adults. Seeing our phone can often be a trigger for our, a mental trigger for our cause for concern. So if your child is telling you they need it for an alarm clock, go out, as many schools have done in recent years, and parents, and buy your child a tick-tocking alarm clock. If you're in a lucky position where your children are still young and you've still got some sort of locus of control over their behavior and their actions, start from a young age. Establish that bedrooms really are a no-go tech zone. And the one that's really tricky to manage here is to actually model that habit yourself. So, as I suggested before, having a digital bedtime for devices, and ideally 60 to 90 minutes before the child or the teen goes to sleep. And again, on that circle wheel, and again, that will be in the handouts, suggesting when that will be based on their wake time and their sleep time will help. Now, if children, and I understand some families do use technology as part of their evening routine, and that can be okay for some students and some children, what I suggest is look for better alternatives before bed. So if technology is part of the evening routine, watching television, for example, is a much better choice than using a handheld device like a smartphone or a tablet or using a laptop. For a couple of reasons, televisions emit far less blue light than, and depending on the type of TV you have, but generally TVs emit far less blue light, and we also tend, hopefully, to sit a lot further away from TVs than we do handheld devices. So we're much less likely to absorb some of the negative blue light effects. Reading an ebook. Most Kindles and ebook readers do not emit any blue light. In fact, they use a totally different lighting system, so they're not a problem at all. But an ebook before night is a better choice. Doing something passive. You know, TV is also a really good choice because it tends to, at the moment, be very passive. We don't tend to be interactive and engaging, so it can be a good way for kids to wind down. Listening to music, listening to a podcast, or perhaps listening to some guided meditations or mindfulness apps. And again, I will have a resource sheet, and these resources will be in the resource sheet as well. So some screen alternatives before students go to bed. For preschoolers and toddlers, Birdie, a speaker system with a whole range of curated content, particularly audio content, is also another great choice before kids go to bed. I mentioned before, I want to reassure you, Kindles are okay. When I run sessions with students, many kids come up and tell me they're reading ebooks and Kindles. If you have a dedicated e-reader, i.e. a Kindle or an Kobo or a specific e-reader, they don't emit the blue light. If, however, you are reading ebooks on a tablet or a smartphone, then this can cause some other issues. So some of the apps that I will recommend in the resource section that I mentioned before in terms of mindfulness apps, these are great because not only do they get kids to calm down, but they're a really good use of the technology, and you can actually time them so that they will switch off after an elapsed period of time. So Smiling Mind is a great one, Headspace, but my favorite one at the moment has to be the Calm app. There are a whole lot of meditation and mindfulness tracks, and these have been shown to reduce anxiety, lower stress, and to promote better sleep. Now, if your child does need to be on a digital device before bed, and I understand sometimes, particularly with adolescents, they need to be doing homework or projects or online activities, using iOS offers a night shift mode, so it can change, and you access this in your settings app, but changing the brightness into a night shift mode. If you've got Android, using a blue light filter or twilight, these are tools that you can download, but basically it changes the color setting. And you can time this so that it alters this at particular times of the day to try and accommodate your circadian rhythm. If you're on a desktop or a laptop computer, using an app called Efflux, again, it changes the brightness of the screen. If you don't have those features, if you don't want to purchase additional things, just dimming the brightness of any screen that you are using or your child is using will really help to minimize the blue light effects. Now again, if you do need to be using devices, what I recommend, I strongly personally use and strongly recommend Baxter Blue Glasses. They will, if you use their promo code, offer free shipping. So that is a really good product. These are blue light blocking glasses that do block out about 50% of the blue light that screens emit. They have products for both kids and adults. And I will admit, I don't walk my talk, so I'm often wearing these devices before I go to bed to try and counteract some of the negative effects of screens. What I also suggest is to families is specifying a landing zone to start to promote these healthy screen habits and digitally disconnecting before they go to bed. Designate a specific explicit spot in the house where the 15 iPads, 12 smartphones, and 18 laptops all go to be charged. You can do the digital head count before you go to bed, but a word of warning as a parent, make sure that when you are doing the digital head count that you're actually counting the device and not just the empty case. I know many parents have been duped into thinking their kids are charging devices when all they've done is in fact put an empty case there to charge. And another warning, if your child, particularly your teenager, hands over their digital appendage without a lot of fuss or friction, be really curious, because chances are that if they do, they probably have a decoy phone or device somewhere else. So now I'm going to give you some more pragmatic strategies that aren't related necessarily to technology. One of them is that we need to make sure our kids and teens are getting a sufficient amount of what I call green time. Natural sunlight, particularly between the hours of 8 a.m. and 12 p.m., will really help to reset and regulate their circadian rhythms. You see, if we get natural sunlight early in the morning, not only does it promote our circadian rhythm and help us to regulate that, but it's also interestingly been connected to having a lower body mass index. Light basically sends a strong signal to your body and your brain to wake up, so it helps us to feel aroused in the morning, and it also helps to regulate our body clock so that it can make sure that we are getting a sufficient amount of sleep. So I recommend early in the morning, as I said, between 8 a.m. to 12 p.m., and making sure your child gets at minimum 10 to 15 hours of natural sunlight a week. The added bonus is that it will also help to offset the likelihood of developing myopia, nearsightedness. Some other studies have indicated that one of the ways that we can help, again, particularly our adolescents who struggle to wake up in the morning, is that when the alarm goes off, turning on a lamp near them, whether it's you or the adolescent, helps to, again, trigger the circadian rhythm so they get the idea that they need to wake up. If you can, opening curtains even just a little bit the night before, but the natural sunlight will make a really big difference in terms of waking you up. So make sure you get lots of natural sunlight, and it will help with that promoting that healthy green time. Also, dimming the lights at night. So trying to avoid fluorescent lights in your house, turning on candles or lights with dimmers, or lamps instead of bright overhead lights. Close the curtains before bedtime. Any sort of light mechanism that you can use. Basically, the brain needs to be prepared or primed for sleeping. And again, this is preparing that circadian rhythm to know that sleep is soon on its way. Another strategy I found personally really helpful, and I know this works particularly with children and adolescents that suffer from anxiety. But for me as an adult, it really helps with what I call the mental load or the mother load. Journal and write down your ideas. Doing basically a brain dump, but getting out all of the ideas. We know one of the reasons that sleep is often compromised is because of stress or anxiety. And if we can offload some of our cognitive resources before we go to sleep, it can minimize the chances of this happening. We also have a lot of evidence that tells us that a nap can work really well. And we've all heard a lot of high-profile companies like Google and Cisco and Procter & Gamble have actually started to offer their employees an alternative to having their afternoon coffee, and that is a nap pod at work. Now, not everybody has access to a nap pod, and there's some really important things, particularly with young people, if we're going to offer a nap. So what I'm going to say is we don't recommend young children have a nap if they experience any of these symptoms. If they have trouble falling asleep at night, staying asleep at night, or if they wake up too early. Having a nap can really exacerbate those symptoms. However, what we know is that our brain builds up what we called before sleep pressure. And this builds up during the day as we're awake, and it peaks right before we fall asleep at night. Now, if you take a nap during the day, what you're basically doing is decreasing your sleep pressure, so it will be harder for you to wake up, to sleep throughout the night. High sleep pressure at night, having spent an entire day awake, really helps you to fall asleep, stay asleep, and not wake up too early. But it also means that if you have trouble sleeping at night, it's particularly important to have a high sleep pressure at night. Now, if you don't meet those criteria, it's okay for you to have a nap, or your teen or your child to have a nap. The next step is to decide how much time they should have for a nap. And basically, there are two types of naps. The first is a power nap, and the second is a recovery nap. So a power nap is generally no more than 20 minutes, and this stops us from going into deep sleep. The reason that we need to prevent deep sleep is that waking up out of deep sleep is unpleasant and difficult. We've all been there when our toddlers had, you know, a 2 or 3 hour nap. I know when I was recently pregnant, the days I'd have a much longer nap, waking up was really onerous. So a shorter nap will contain light sleep, and it will make it easier to wake up and have a positive impact on your attention, your concentration levels, believe it or not, for up to 3 hours after your nap. So that 20 minute nap can really be time well spent. The second type of nap is a recovery nap, and as the name suggests, it is a little longer, basically about 90 minutes. And what will happen is you'll fall asleep, and it will ensure that you get a full sleep cycle. So this nap will contain both light and deep sleep, and some people might even get to REM or dream sleep. A longer nap can have a number of positive effects, particularly on your attention, your memory, your mood, and your physical health, but it really can compromise that sleep pressure that we were talking about before. So we recommend not taking a recovery nap on a Sunday. Now, we know many kids do this. We have busy weeks, and the weekend there's often time to squeeze a nap in. But the long recovery nap can be great, but it can really backfire on a Sunday. Why is this? Well, any type of nap will diminish your sleep pressure at night, but a long recovery nap can really reduce a child or a teen's sleep pressure significantly, much more than a shorter nap. And the issue with a Sunday night is that many people already have trouble falling to sleep. We know Mondayitis is a real thing, so the stress associated with Mondays can often hamper our sleep. And on top of that, many of us sleep in on a Sunday morning, which means that our brain has already had less time to build up the sleep pressure across the day. So it's basically a double whammy. We sleep in, and we have no sleep pressure at night if we've had a nap. And so this really means that we should avoid the nap on a Sunday. If your child or teen really needs a catch-up nap, we generally recommend doing it on a Saturday, where they might be able to stay up a little bit later. But the general rule is we really shouldn't deviate very much at all. The research suggests usually no more than an hour of their normal bedtime should be when children and teens stay up. So how do you then ascertain when you should have a nap? In the handouts, I will provide you with a link. There is a great tool. It's called a nap calculator, but it will basically calculate when you need to have a nap or your child needs to have a nap based on what time of the day they need to wake up. They have done studies that prove that there are particular times of the day, again, based on building up that sleep pressure. Generally, and it's a very, very general rule, usually somewhere between 2 to 3 p.m. coincides with most adults dip in our biological clock. And it's enough time to then build up that sleep pressure until we fall asleep. Another tip if your child or teen naps is get them active afterwards. Even if we just have that very quick nap, the power nap of 20 minutes, we need time afterwards to invigorate ourselves. So getting energized by doing some sort of physical activity can be a great way to boost that energy and to dissipate that groggy feeling as well. So there's the link to this nap wheel that I was talking about. It's a great tool that will really help you specify what time it is. Basically, you want the intersection between these two colors here. So if I'm waking up at 7 a.m., somewhere around 2 p.m., somewhere between even 1 and 2 p.m. is a good time for a nap. So keep it short, keep it simple, make sure for most children and teen they have no more than the power nap, and maybe you could create a product like this for your sleepy teenager. As I mentioned before, avoid sleep-ins, really important, particularly on weekends, because what happens with a sleep-in is it doesn't build up sleep pressure. So we need to make sure, again, that if we are going to have a sleep-in, it's only done on a Saturday, and if they are going to occur really not much longer than an hour past their regular wake-up time, just to help those circadian rhythms regulate. Now, I mentioned it before, but it's worth saying again, I married a builder, and when we move, we moved house quite a lot, having married a builder, and when we move to a new house, I like to plant a frangipani tree, and a couple of times I have been known to, after the frangipani tree has been planted, to say to my husband, I'd like you to move it to the other side of the backyard, or it doesn't look right there, or I don't like it where it is, or it's in front of the cubby house, or the kids are going to jump on the trampoline from the frangipani tree, so I asked my husband to move it. Now, usually he says something under his breath, but he agrees to do it anyway. But if we were to leave that frangipani tree and it was to establish its roots and to start to flower and to start to grow and thrive, my husband would say a whole lot more than a couple of things under his breath. It would be a lot more challenging, a lot more expensive, and it probably wouldn't work if we were to transplant the frangipani tree. The same thing is true with kids and technology habits. Start early, create the habits early, and it will pay dividends further on down the track. Another few quick little tips to promote healthy sleep. If your children or teens travel, or you do for your work, there are ironically some really great apps. Time Shifter is probably my favorite. And it's an Android and an iOS device, but it's based on the latest research in sleep and circadian neuroscience. And basically, it combines a whole lot of elements that research has shown will help you reset your circadian clock. So it will look at light exposure and melatonin levels, and it will also look at symptoms that will alleviate sleeplessness, such as melatonin, caffeine, and naps. So whether you're traveling for vacation or pleasure or sports, this can be a really great app at helping you try and regulate sleep patterns. There are all sorts of apps and tracking devices out there. The one that I really like is one called Sleep. It's not a typo or a bad form of pronunciation, but it is a sleep aid, and it will really improve sleep through a number of topics. It looks at relaxation, technology, and snoozing, and it's definitely an app. Another product that I highly recommend is an app or a tool, a ring called Aura, slightly more expensive and probably not something I would buy for kids and teens, but for adults who are interested in their sleep hygiene, Aura is definitely a tool to consider. And what do we do? I'm going to wrap up here. What if you've got a child or a teenager that has developed some unhealthy sleep habits? Don't go in cold turkey and make radical changes. Don't ban the iPad and take away their phones and make them go to bed at 7 o'clock. It won't work. Make small incremental changes over time. The other thing I've also found is provide reasoning, particularly for boys and adolescents, giving them science and facts behind reasons for your changes, and then gradually crowd out their unhealthy sleep habits. Rather than just enforcing bans or limits, generally crowding out the undesired behavior with more desirable behaviors. So for example, instead of saying, look, I don't want you on your phone at night, say, well, instead of using your phone, would you like to have a warm bath? Instead of, you know, spending hours on social media, could we read a book together, or could we watch a movie together? Just crowding out those behaviors over time. So finally, if you are concerned in any way, please, what I would do before you go and seek medical help, and you definitely should if you have any concerns about your child or your teenager's sleep, there might be other underlying issues, underlying health, physical health issues, or even mental health issues that could be the root cause. Before you do, what I would recommend, and in most instances from my experience, health professionals will ask you to keep a sleep journal or a diary, usually for 7 to 14 days beforehand. So in the resource link below, there is a sleep diary that you can use, and I would recommend doing that if you are concerned in any way by your child or teen. So there we have it, our mini masterclass all about how we can ensure that screens aren't sabotaging our sleep, with realistic solutions, hopefully, and some practical ideas to help you navigate this digital landscape without, as I say, digitally amputating kids. Thank you for your time and your attention, and I hope I can help you in another way soon. Bye for now.